This episode is brought to you by the Women's Network.
So when I met with her finally, after we'd been introduced, I remember at the end of the meeting, she said, "So what can I do for you?" Because she's so used to people draining the energy from her. And I remember saying, "Nothing. I just thought it would be beneficial for us to meet. And I really appreciate your time." So later on, she sent me an email after I sent my thank you note saying that she was grateful to be in my orbit. And I thought, holy cow. I was just excited to breathe the same oxygen as you for a few minutes. And that really was what began a long relationship. It was not asking for anything, purely adding.
Welcome to Redefining Ambition, Ariel, Patrick. So happy to have you on.
Thank you for having me. What an incredible community that you've built with the Women's Network, and very excited to share some of what I know.
And huge congratulations. You just had a baby girl. How are you doing and how is your family doing?
Thank you. I will say that under eye concealer is the best thing in the world. I hadn't realized it until this experience. But no, we are overjoyed and exhausted and confused and thrilled all at once, which I think is when you know you're doing life right.
And this is your first child.
Yes.
First child. Wow.
Yes. My husband and I just got married in August of last year. So we haven't even had our 1 year anniversary yet. We're a couple months shy. So this was a fun surprise on the road that is life.
Wow. And when did you get married? Where did you get married?
August 2021. We had our ceremony at Temple Emmanuel, which is a Jewish synagogue that we're members of. And it's actually the oldest Reform synagogue in North America. Stunning cathedral looking space. And then we had the reception at the Metropolitan Club. It was quite dreamy, and we were just very lucky that everything went off without a hitch, especially in the pandemic. We had gotten very, very fortunate and were able to celebrate with family and friends right before the Delta variant hit us. So everyone was freshly vaxxed and thrilled. And then of course, sadly in the fall, things took another turn, but feeling very grateful.
You have a crystal ball. You got engaged 10 days before everything shut down in March of 2020. And I want to get into more of that. So you are the daughter of immigrants. You grew up in New York City. You're currently based in Manhattan.
Yes.
You went to the Chapin School, and one of my colleagues also went to the Chapin School. I know we spoke about this, and I would love to learn more too about the importance of a community, particularly a community of young women, girls. What was your early upbringing like, and what was your relationship to success? What were some of the values that were instilled in you by your parents?
Sure. I am a proud product of tiger parenting, which of course became a phrase when that book came out, but my parents very much designed the model far before it became a tagline. It was a childhood that was full of so much love, but also a really big emphasis on discipline. Everything from making sure that you start your day the right way, making your bed, to, you know, hours of piano lessons and rehearsal on the weekends, to not only getting homework done, but also having extra math homework assigned by my mother because she believed that we needed extra reinforcement to be excellent. So when I look back, I just feel incredibly fortunate, and there's so much that I will replicate. But I do think that a big part of the way I was raised was because my parents immigrated to the United States, both when they were very, very young. My father essentially was born here. He came here when he was only a couple months old, and his family was already based here. But my grandmother actually went back to the Caribbean to deliver him with her favorite doctor. And my mom came here when she was, I think, about 8 years old. And you'd think that they would become more Americanized, but actually they really, really hung on to a lot of what they were taught by their parents who came to the United States in the 70s.
Wow. What do you think, in discussing the role that education played in your life early on, taught you to this day? Was it something that has affected you in, I'm sure, positive ways too? It helped to get you to where you are today. But what were some of the negative or the more detrimental components of having so much discipline academically too? The pressure, I'm sure, was immense.
Sure. I will say that a lot of the pressure that I have been under my entire life is self-inflicted. Now, of course, is that possibly taught, right? The inclination to expect a lot from yourself, of course. But my parents definitely exercised a lot of compassion. It was tough love. But I think what I struggled with up until probably the age of around 27 was self-compassion. I really, really think that we are our own harshest critics. And sometimes that can turn into a toxic relationship with yourself where you don't allow yourself even an inch and you don't treat yourself the way that you would others. I often remind myself to treat myself as well as I treat my best friends. And I can sometimes eviscerate myself when I make a mistake or push myself to a limit that perhaps isn't necessary. And I always think, if a friend came to me with this struggle, what would I say to them? And if I'm not saying the same thing to myself, then I'm not doing it correctly. I do think that self-compassion is something that has actually accelerated my career. So it gets you only so far, right? When I started my career, I was at a PR agency. I got promoted 6 times in 5 years. It was a skyrocket to quote unquote the middle, right? So I made it to VP level and felt really good about myself. And then when I was poached to another agency to be a leader, right? I was poached at the age of 28 to be an SVP, moved up to EVP there. The things that make you successful when you're at the top are completely different. So execution, the grind, all of that works until a certain point, but then building closer relationships with people is really how you become more successful. I think people only work hard for leaders that they trust and believe in. And so if you don't trust and believe in yourself and you don't have self-compassion, it's really impossible to be the most empathetic and motivating leader that you can be. So that was a big growth area for me and sort of why I went down the path of practicing mindfulness and learning more about how tools like self-compassion can take you to the next level.
I love all of that. What are examples of ways that one can practice self-compassion? You mentioned practicing mindfulness, meditation. What are other ways? Is it affirming yourself?
Oh goodness, there are so many tools. The first is learning to stay present. I think that often we project in our brains and think to the next chapter and allow that to sort of blind us from the beauty of what's around us every day. So I do practice something when I feel a lot of anxiety or I feel that I'm about to behave in a way that's almost getting over my skis. And it's called the 5 senses exercise. So I just identify to myself something I can hear, smell, touch, et cetera, see, and just record that in my brain and actually sort of sit in it. I know that sounds strange, but that is a form of meditation. I think when people think of meditation, they think it's inaccessible to them and you have to sit, close your eyes and focus. Not everyone can do that. Some people's lifestyles are not set up for that, but those are ways in which you can meditate just in your day-to-day life. And it only takes 30 seconds. So I think staying present has been a huge part. Affirmations are, of course, incredibly important. I always remind myself that I am kind, powerful, and strong. That is actually a tagline I stole from my favorite Peloton instructor. Shout out to Adrian Williams. He's the best run coach in the Peloton community. And I think other tools include, like I said, reminding yourself of how you would treat others and try to treat yourself the same way. So practicing sort of stepping outside of yourself and having this conversation with a friend or someone dear to you, like a family member, and sort of switching the script on yourself, that really helps. And that'll also help you see what others see, right? When you put out certain energy in the world, whether it be in a work context or in a friendship, just having more empathy from the outside, I think helps us all be better to ourselves and to others.
I love all of that. I couldn't agree more. So you graduate from the Chapin School. Can you talk more about the power of community and what that school meant to you, what you really got out of the environment?
Oh, goodness. Chapin was the best experience of my life. So it's one of the oldest all-girls schools in the United States. I was very, very privileged to go there. And I think it seems fairly obvious, but there is something incredibly powerful about being in a community where the student body president, the head of school, the head of the upper school, middle school, lower school are all powerful women that you look up to. I hadn't really considered or thought that it was inaccessible to be a leader as a woman because that's actually all I knew. So when I went to college, there was probably a brief culture shock for the first couple of weeks, but I actually think that I was really well positioned to speak up in class and be more vocal and advocate for myself in ways that perhaps other women were not. So it just kind of sticks with you. It was just a beautiful experience. And it's one that I hope I can give my daughter when she gets older.
That's amazing. So you go off to Princeton, where you studied classics with a concentration on ancient Greek and Latin language, literature, and history. Can you talk more about your experience on campus and more specifically your ideas on what you felt or thought at the time you knew what you wanted to do with your career? What interests did you have? And what is the, in your own opinion, importance of your major? Is it to learn more about a particular discipline or topic that you would then pursue a career out of?
Sure. To put it plainly, I just allowed myself to explore the academic world. I mean, that's one of the most beautiful things about being at a liberal arts college, rather than a more trade-oriented institution, is that you're just free to expand your mind. When I went to college, I, of course, had studied Latin and ancient Greek since middle school, actually, but which I know I was very privileged to do, and it was amazing to be able to continue that. But I think the other part of the privilege was just being able to focus on my studies without worrying too much about what I was going to do later. The things that I loved to do were write, research, and read. Those were my favorite things. And so I just continued to do those things until I found a career that valued those skills. So I tried a ton of different internships throughout college. I initially wanted to be exactly like my father, who's a journalist. He's a television journalist, but I really wanted to do print. And sort of an interesting confluence of events took place. So I was interning in publishing. It was around 08, 09, 2010, 2011, when the publishing world kind of collapsed around the financial crisis. The Daily Beast and the Huffington Post were how people were getting their news. It was a disruption, right? And I wasn't really that interested in clickbait. So my father actually was the one, and my mom, they both recommended that I try the other side of the journalism world, which was public relations. I had no idea what it was. And interestingly, that summer that I interned at a PR firm, it was also around the time that Occupy Wall Street was happening. Financial firms were hiring PR firms at very, very high fees to protect their reputations. It was one of the first times that institutions, especially those that were initially deemed too big to fail, had to actually consider what the average Joe thought of them. And really, it was the Achilles heel was reputation. So I just became incredibly drawn to that, kind of just followed the trends I was seeing and found myself in this industry. But back to your initial question, I would not have been as remarkable at a young age at what I did or as perceptive if I hadn't been a student of literature. Narrative, storytelling, analysis, all those things are incredibly critical to a successful career in public relations and communications and marketing. And you don't really have to study those things directly in order to be good at what you do. In fact, I'm probably generally more inclined to hire a comparative literature or English major than I am someone who studied advertising in college, because I do think it's a bit too limiting to focus on case studies and sort of that very concrete way of learning. I think people who can apply anything to anything are often more nimble, more creative. So long story short, if you're listening, just focus on studying what you love and the rest will come later through internships. I think that's the best way to get your chops over the summer, but I don't think that what you study on campus is incredibly critical to getting that first job.
I'm so glad you said that. There's so much pressure to feel like you have to have it all figured out in college, that your major determines your entire career trajectory. So that's great to hear. So you graduate and you take a job at Weber Shandwick. And like you mentioned, you're promoted 6 times over the course of 5 years. But when you began, how did you develop a sense of confidence as you're able to continue to grow within the company? And more specifically, within the realm of finance, you did not come from you did not study finance in school. Did you feel like you were left out, missing components of technical training?
No, I was such a nerd that I knew I could pick up anything. So I actually had assigned myself a reading list when I first started. I would read Barron's, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times every single morning. And if I hadn't read the financial headlines and tried to digest them and looked up any terms I didn't know on Investopedia, I felt that I was behind the ball. So I actually took it upon myself to get to work an hour early and read as much as I could so that I could stay atop the latest news, and also be able to ask probing questions if there was something I didn't know walking into the workday. I also purchased some textbooks. So, you know, later on in my career, I ended up focusing on mergers and acquisitions and restructuring, which are very complex financial deals. And so I bought these books that still sit on my bookshelf today on publicly traded company M&A, private capital M&A, and, you know, a few other things, and really read them cover to cover and used them to look up terms whenever I was in a room and felt that people were talking over me and I didn't know what was going on. I would just write down the terms I didn't know and then go back to my desk and look them up, or even just hop on Investopedia under the table on my phone. So I think it's really, you know, it kind of goes back to your earlier question about how your education lends itself to how you work. I just kind of grew up as a researcher, and that played well to my benefit. The other thing that was really helpful was building as many relationships as early as I could. So spending 5 years at the same firm, was actually 5.5, you just develop these incredible friendships and mentorships. And so I really reached beyond the direct teams I was working on to introduce myself to senior people throughout the organization, ask them about what they did, turn them into mentors and sponsors, and get them interested and invested in my career and helping me grow. And that's how certain opportunities came my way. So, you know, even though I was at the same firm for 5.5 years, I had many different roles. I actually switched practices. Those opportunities don't just sit on your lap. You have to, or fall into your lap. You have to navigate the institution and tell people proactively what you're interested in, what gets you up in the morning, what you want to learn more about, and they will connect the dots when the right opportunities come their way.
That's amazing advice. So what is an example of reaching out to someone who's much more senior to your junior and sharing more about yourself and eventually hopefully converting them to be a sponsor or a mentor, naturally doing so in a way that feels authentic?
Sure. So one of the things I did earlier on in my career was I developed a little newsletter that I would send to people with the latest headlines and other trends that were going on in the spaces that were of interest to our team and our firm. And so I would just email those around on Fridays. That was a really good way to develop relationships with people. So whenever I'd met somebody, I would add them to the mailing list or just shoot it to them one off and say, hey, thought you'd be interested in this article. I know you worked on this client project. Here's something that's happened in that same sector. And many times, of course, these are sophisticated, seasoned executives. They've seen the article, or they've probably read or have an intimate knowledge of the matter. But I was just showing that I was also paying attention and thinking of them. And of course, there were the rare cases where I was bringing them something new, and that would spur an additional conversation. So I think people forget that you are not, when you are a mentee, you are not there to siphon energy and information from another person. You're also there to add and be of service. So it's a two-way street. And people are very rarely inclined to, at least for a prolonged period, invest in you as a mentor if they don't feel that they're getting something out of the relationship as well.
I always hear people ask, I am so much younger. I have less experience than people who I want to be my mentor, who I want to reach out to. I don't know how to continue this two-way street. I feel like I am taking much more than I'm giving. You shared one example. What are other authentic, natural, not forced ways of cultivating a relationship with someone who is more senior, has more influence at the firm?
You can also be a connector. Even if your Rolodex is relatively limited because you're younger or you're starting out, doesn't mean that you can't put some brain power into introducing them to people who they may benefit from knowing. So I can't really think of many instances where I've asked people to connect me with other people. It's usually the other way around, and I like it that way. I think being a connector is one of my superpowers, but it can be anyone's. Just think about common traits, common interests, synergies between the businesses they do, and just say, hey, I thought that you would benefit from knowing this person. I'm not sure what might come from it, but we'll see. And I always joke that now at this point in my career, I should start charging people, because you wouldn't believe how many connections I've made have gone on to do business together, to work together, to make magic together. So maybe there's going to be a commission model coming. I'm joking. Yeah. But I think that's a really altruistic way to be of service. So sharing intel, making connections. And I think a third might just be keeping them updated on what you're doing. I think people genuinely want to know that if they've invested time in a mentee, that they want to know that they're doing well. You wouldn't believe how many times people have come to me asking for an introduction or asking me for a favor, and I never hear from them again. And then later on, I find out that the job I helped them get, they actually left, or you know, something not so great has happened. That makes the mentor feel slighted in a way. I mean, if you invest, you kind of want to have an understanding of how that's going, help them solve through the issues. So, you know, staying in touch, I think, is a really important piece as well, just because if you get someone invested in your story, you probably have to continue telling the story.
Of course. And I'm guessing that happens more often than people think. So the median tenure for workers ages 25 to 34 is about 2.8 years, roughly 3 years of staying at the same firm and then leaving. You stayed at the same firm for 5.5 years. You were then poached by a competitor and rose through the ranks quickly, going from SVP to EVP. It requires a different set of skills, which is what you alluded to and mentioned. When did you feel like you had the confidence, the skills, the leadership to serve in these capacities? Do you always feel once you got to that position, that senior level, that you could do this, even if you didn't always feel that? Or when was the moment that shifted?
I don't think there's ever one moment. I think it's a journey. Are there moments where I think I knew enough to be dangerous and maybe faked it a tiny bit in the room just because I wanted to gain the confidence of my clients and, you know, would of course ask for advice later and then bring the knowledge that I gleaned back to the table? Absolutely. You know, sometimes that's just needed for survival. I think knowing what you don't know is probably the most critical part of being successful. I don't think that you do yourself any favors by saying, okay, this is the moment where I've made it and I know everything. Right now, even I'm in the middle of a stretch opportunity. So, right, I was senior on the agency side. I loved serving clients. Now I'm in-house. And it's a completely different ball game. Every single day, I feel like I have to push myself to be more creative than I've ever been. You know, when you're on the agency side, you work on a project, it ends, you move on, and you don't see the full life cycle of how the work that you've done impacts every inch of an institution. Now, everything I do impacts our employees, our clients, our shareholders, right? Other constituents that care about our firm. So I have to constantly think about ways to build on the work that I've done and push myself to be even more creative than ever before on an ongoing, prolonged basis. It never ends. I go to sleep thinking about the firm and I wake up thinking about the firm. It really is my baby. So that's a totally different energy. I use that as an example just because we're never done learning, right? Am I a master at certain things? Absolutely. But I always try to push myself toward the things that I don't know and pull in as many experts as possible to help me get better.
in order to get to this point, you in your career, I'm sure you've received so much feedback along the way. And I'm curious, what has been the most important piece of feedback or pieces of feedback you've received? And what was some of the most difficult feedback you've received?
I'm not trying to avoid the question, but really I seek feedback every single day. Feedback is a gift. So I can't really think of one piece of feedback that was particularly damaging or discouraging, or one piece of feedback that was particularly enlightening. I have those moments every single day. So if I run an all staff meeting at our firm, I always ask at least a few people, how do you think that went? What do you think people's responses were to the topics that we covered? How could I have done better? I always do the recap, no matter what it is. And I think people need to stop seeing feedback as some sort of affront or attack and really view it as a gift. People don't spend time to give you feedback if they don't want you to succeed. So if they're going to take the time to share something with you, even if you think they're wrong, just try to sit and think, what am I learning from this? What is the glimmer of truth? Whatever the glimmer of truth is something that you'll take with you for the rest of your life. And that's definitely something that I've learned from my boss, who has coined the term feedback as a gift. You know, even at her level as our co-CEO and as this incredible board director at publicly traded companies, she still every day finds herself saying, what can I learn from this? Especially when it's a negative experience.
So you leave Edelman, you take a job at Ariel Investments, which is the first Black-owned investment firm in the United States. Your boss, you just mentioned, is Melody Hobson, the chairwoman of Starbucks. She's the co-CEO of your firm. She also was listed by Forbes as one of the world's most powerful women, just this incredible woman, trailblazer. What have been, in your experience of working with her, some of the most important lessons you've learned or derived from your time with her? And what has she taught you that sticks with you? I'm sure it's a lot.
Oh goodness, there's so much. But I think the story of how we ended up working together is a good learning on mentorship and sponsorship, the way that we were just talking about how people can migrate from simply asking to offering. So I actually met her about 7 or maybe 8 years ago now through a mutual contact. It was actually Gail King who introduced us, who I had a connection with, and through my dad. And when we made the ask to meet Melody, it was purely out of curiosity. I mean, she is someone who went to Princeton, is a Black woman. We have a lot in common. And so the question was just, could I share air with her for even 5 minutes just to make the introduction and learn, or just feel that the connection was made? So there was no agenda. There was no ask. So when I met with her finally, after we'd been introduced, I remember at the end of the meeting, she said, so what can I do for you? Because she's so used to people draining the energy from her. And I remember saying nothing. I just thought it would be beneficial for us to meet. And I really appreciate your time. So later on, she sent me an email after I sent my thank you note saying that she was grateful to be in my orbit. And I thought, holy cow, I was just excited to breathe the same oxygen as you for a few minutes. And that really was what began a long relationship. It was not asking for anything, purely adding. So if I ever saw something that I thought she'd be interested in, I'd just shoot her a note. She had invited me to a couple events. You know, one was at the Economic Club in Chicago. I flew out just to see her speak and hear her insights. She was speaking with Jamie Dimon. She invited me to the opening of the New York office at Ariel, or the newer one that we're in now. And it was just this back and forth of just staying in touch. I would keep her updated on new roles or new opportunities that I'd been able to achieve, and, you know, always thanked her just for simply existing and giving me that inspiration. And of course, when the time came when she was looking for somebody to lead communications at Ariel, who does she call? Me. Not because I had aggressively tried to prove something or had asked for the opportunity. It was because I was the person that came to mind when she was thinking about the next chapter of the firm. And so I think that's a testament to that model, right? The give and take.
That's incredible. And you met her too young. You met her.
Yeah, I was probably It was 8 years ago, whatever that is. I'm 33. So yeah, I was young. I'm still young. And I knew what I didn't know. And I knew that she was someone who knew a lot. And that was really it. Just being adjacent to someone who's so inspiring. I think that alone, that relationship can be beneficial in the future, but you don't walk into it expecting anything on a certain timeline or assuming that you'll be able to cash in later on. That's not how relationships work. It's like a friendship.
Arielle, that's an incredible story. Wow. It must be like a full circle moment too, to work with someone that you've known for all these years and you can continue to learn from. And I'm sure she learns just as much from you.
I should hope so. I view myself as her consigliere on all things reputation and communications. And it's such an honor. I sound speechless because I am. It's a really beautiful time in my life. And I do not spend any moment taking it for granted.
That's incredible. Thank you for sharing that. So at your firm, you're the chief communications officer. You lead all things brand, comms, marketing, events. I think I'm missing another department. But
philanthropy, media relations, government relations.
A huge team of intersecting parts around the firm. So your team worked on the inaugural Black Corporate Director Study, which came out, was published a few months ago, and you later went on Bloomberg to speak more to it. And I wanted to spend some time talking about this. So one of the findings of the study was that 62% of diverse directors feel race receives too little attention from leadership, while 54% of US white men and 40% of white women believe that leadership pays too much attention to race. The study also revealed that there's a gap between what leaders are talking about at the top when it comes to the topic of DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, and what, quote, employees are actually buying. So I'm curious, you also went on Bloomberg and shared that historically DEI initiatives have largely benefited white women and that the next chapter of the larger DEI discussion is going to be more focused on race. What key component of the topic and this conversation around DEI has been missing? And that includes intersectionality as well. I'm curious if you could elaborate on that.
Sure. So I'll take you back in time. So the reason why we did this study, my brainchild, it was so fun to work on. So for the past 20 years, Ariel has hosted the Black Corporate Directors Conference, which is an off-the-record gathering in California where we bring together board directors who are predominantly Black, but also Latino and Latina, of the largest, most influential Fortune 500 publicly traded companies. And what we do during that summit is really talk through key challenges, opportunities, but the most important part is the calls to action. So at the end of the conference, there are a set of agenda items that we expect our leaders that are in our orbit to bring to their respective boardrooms that they can make change in the spaces that they occupy. So it was an honor to work on my first Black Corporate Directors Conference last year and continue that legacy. And one of the things that I had talked about with Melody and also another mentor of mine, Devin Spurgeon, really brilliant woman who's also a communications expert and a friend of Melody's, was that it's so rare to have this captive audience of the most influential Black and Latina and Latino corporate directors and not get a sense of what they're thinking and publish that. So we came up with a list of questions, asked them about how we're doing on governance of DEI issues, how we're doing on representation, how these initiatives are being funded, from a financial standpoint, of course, at these institutions. And then I think the most critical part is how they are being executed strategically at these institutions. That is the Achilles heel. So what I learned is that representation isn't enough, right? So all these companies have been coming out with new appointments, new hires, saying we have a Black woman on our board, or we have a Latino male as the CEO. We've done our job. That is unfortunately not where we succeed. Where we succeed is actually what those individuals are doing, what they're overseeing, how their skills are being leveraged in the spaces that they're occupying. So You know, as you know, in you know, on boards, there are multiple committees. There's the finance and audit committee. There's the nominating and governance committee, which is responsible for recruiting additional board members. Those are the spaces where the brain power of diverse individuals who are passionate about the civil rights agenda should be used, right? So making sure that diversity, equity, inclusion, and the impact that companies have on marginalized communities is actually part of the risk and audit framework. Making sure that you have people on the, you know, nominating and governance committee that are committed to hiring talented people or recruiting talented people that are diverse, but also looking critically at their skill set to make sure that they're additive. Those are the places, right? So basically what we found is that there's been a lot of announcements and pronouncements and appointments and press releases put out. But where the work needs to be done is in making sure that those individuals are empowered to have the utmost influence. The second piece is making sure that diversity, equity, inclusion isn't just viewed as an HR matter. So whenever people talk about DEI, they keep talking about how many workers they have that are diverse or, you know, something that's related to talent. Talent is a small piece of a larger way to employ DEI strategies. So you have to look at whether you're hiring diverse suppliers and vendors in your business, whether you are holding your team accountable for meeting those numbers and tying compensation to those goals, whether you are looking at your philanthropic giving and creating lasting long-term partnerships with institutions that impact underserved communities, not just giving one-time gifts so that you can make yourself look good. So these are all, so we call it the three P's: people, purchasing, and philanthropy. So people, not only recruiting diverse talent, but also making sure that they stay and are in positions of power. Purchasing, making sure that you have a commitment to diversity in your supply chain and in your vendor base, not only in service-oriented businesses, but also in high-margin businesses like law firms, advertising firms, tech firms, healthcare firms. And then philanthropy, right? Not just one-off gifts, but long-term partnerships and really a rigorous way of tracking the impact of the dollars that you are donating. So very, very long answer to your very simple question, but I wanted to explain sort of how this came about and also where we're seeing room for progress. So really, it's all of those things. And I think the main issue that we're trying to solve for is making sure that the companies that we invest in as a firm, but also the institutions that we just touch through the relationships we have with these board directors, can take these action items and build more rigorous tracking mechanisms to ensure that they're meeting those goals in the same way that they would financial goals or other strategic goals.
What was something that was of a surprise that came out of either the results or the reaction to the survey, the findings?
I think that stat you just said, which is that there's a huge divide between the way diverse directors feel about the importance of DEI and the way the average white male or white female worker feels about DEI. Unfortunately, there needs to be some more education. If you are an employee of a consumer-oriented business, say you're an employee of H&M, and you don't believe that having diverse people on the product innovation and design team is critical, we have a problem. If you look at the consumer base of a company like H&M, it's diverse. So why wouldn't you want to bring those perspectives into the product innovation pipeline proactively to ensure that your products actually speak to various types of people? So I think it's just about leaders avoiding talking about social impact as if it's this soft, feel-good type of thing, and actually being honest about the fact that it's alpha generating and everyone succeeds when you consider DEI as part of your business model. I think that's the education that we need to make sure that there isn't any misunderstanding and you don't have as much blowback from the average worker who feels that they're being somehow pushed out of their positions because they're white, or that this is just some sort of phony trend.
There are so many young people listening to this podcast who I know are deeply passionate about this topic. What would you tell them?
I would tell them to be brave, ask challenging questions. Happy to share some details on the three P's, but I think those are areas in which employers are not used to hearing from employees, right? What are we doing with our vendor base? Are we thinking about looking at women-owned or minority-owned businesses when we put out an RFP for this business? I mean, these are really sophisticated questions that are happening in boardrooms, but can also be happening at various levels throughout the institutions that these leaders can actually feel pressure to have answers.
I also want to briefly talk about your New York Times article. If you're listening to this podcast, you need to read this article. We will link it in the bio. It was, Arielle, amazing. The article profiled you, and you have this quote that I wanted to read. Quote, one of the beautiful things about the 21st century is that the public holds corporate America accountable. No matter how great your company is, humans make mistakes, and all you can do is be ready, stand on the right side of history, and take action immediately. In your opinion, do you think that the public has gone too far, not gone far enough in holding companies accountable? And a follow-up to that, how has this level of accountability made you a better writer, communicator, and leader?
Oh, goodness. So first of all, that quote is about my philosophy when it comes to crisis management. So, you know, the context is really that when you do anything, you have to put it through the risk filter. That's how I operate. So anytime I want to put out an announcement or even just think about a new initiative at work, I always think, what is the counter narrative? What would the haters say? That really helps create these sort of impenetrable narratives. Of course, no narrative is impenetrable, but to the best of my ability, I try to proactively answer any question that any stakeholder would have at the outset. If there's any doubt, it's not thorough enough. And I think understanding that human error is just a natural part of doing business is really important, because a lot of times companies don't think about having a crisis plan or putting things through the risk framework because they say, oh, well, that would never happen to us. No matter how incredible your values are, you are always vulnerable, especially in this environment where anyone in the general public can be considered a journalist. Everyone has a Twitter account. A tweet from an employee can literally drop a stock price. We've seen that happen. Yeah. Everyone is a whistleblower. So you just have to operate from that mindset. Has the public gone too far? Oh, goodness. I think cancel culture is a two-sided coin. Yeah. There are some individuals and some institutions that needed to be canceled. However, I do think that we've migrated to an era where even journalists are guilty of this. We have an allergy to privilege. So anyone who is wealthy or any institution that has been extraordinarily successful financially, I don't think that the public really allows a lot of leeway for people to just succeed without being taken down. And I think we have to move away from that, just because this is America. This is the land of opportunity. I mean, we are a capitalist society. And I kind of thought the purpose of working hard was to take inspiration from those stories and want to be the next unicorn or want to be the next billionaire. But of course, there's also at the same time never been a time where there's such wealth disparity in this country. It's heartbreaking. So equally as much as there are more billionaires than there've ever been before, there's also more poverty than there's ever been before. So I don't have an answer to that question, but I do think we have to stop wanting to burn every privileged person at the stake, because a lot of times those people actually are doing a lot to give back and they're not given the space to do it without being criticized.
So in the article, it also spoke a lot about how productive you are throughout the day. Have you felt burnt out at all throughout your career? And yeah, let me rephrase that. Have you experienced burnout? And how did you overcome that or beat it?
So that's actually really interesting that you asked that, because of the New York Times article, because I was actually concerned when it came out. I was, by the way, so grateful that they've reached out to me to do the piece in the first place. That was a dream, but I was also concerned that talking through my schedule would make it seem that I thought that my schedule was somehow ideal. It's not. I take on sometimes way more than I should. I do find myself depleted at the end of the day often. And I do find myself needing moments where I need to actually remove myself and be more thoughtful and introverted and then come back to the world. But that's actually how I prevent burnout. Of course, I've experienced it. But now at this phase, what I do is I hold myself accountable to making sure that I take a period of time, whether it be a couple of days of being offline or some other setup where I get ahead of the burnout. So even if I'm still feeling really good and I've been burning the midnight oil for a week, I tell myself you have to take PTO on that Friday, because otherwise you won't realize it. But a few weeks from now or a few months from now, you'll feel it in your bones and you'll be really burnt out. So I just encourage people to create some sort of system, a regular moment where you recharge. I happen to be someone who works on the weekends, so I do need to build in those PTO times. For some people, it's just going offline on the weekends, but I don't have that kind of career. So I have to just really be hard on myself and say, you need to take a break even if you feel good. So even in the moments where you feel energized, just know, whether it's every other week or every quarter or once a month, that you need to take that time, whether it be a half day or a couple hours or a full day or a full week. Come up with what works for you and just get ahead of it, because there is no human being that can survive without rest. I thought I was that person, and I learned the hard way when I was younger that I am not that person and no one is.
You are an incredibly inspiring, clearly very powerful woman. And I'm curious, what are the sacrifices that you've made to get to this point that you've reflected on?
So I am smiling because my husband just walked into the room and chuckled and walked back into his room. I heard that, because I would say the sacrifices have actually been in my personal life, unfortunately. I mean, are there moments where I've been unable to make it to a friend's birthday party because I'm working, or moments where I've had to be late to something like a cousin's, you know, music recital? Absolutely. But I think as long as you're honest with people about why you're ambitious and what you want out of it and what your purpose is, I think they're really understanding. I know that the way that I work and the way that I live will be a source of inspiration for my daughter. I know that the work that I'm doing is making the world a better place. And I know that financially it's beneficial to my family. So long as they know that and understand that, it's a lot easier to have those conversations and say, I'm really sorry, I might be late to this, or I might miss this one thing, but I'll make it up to you. And actually just be proactive about doing that. Although I haven't had that problem too recently, because like I said, getting ahead of the burnout, scheduling those PTO days, prioritizing the people that you love during that time, that rigor that I've brought to my rest has actually made my relationships a lot better. But there's of course sacrifice, and it is what it is. I don't really see an alternative, unfortunately.
What is next for you? You just had a baby, and I know you're entering a really exciting new chapter of your life. What's next?
What's next is not having a plan. I just want to focus on the health of my team, making sure that my firm thrives, being as present for my daughter as humanly possible. I mean, literally just today I spent like 10 minutes smelling her hair because the baby smells so delicious. And that was time well spent. Living in the moment, for sure. I think that there have been times in my career where having a 5-year, 10-year plan made a lot of sense, but I'm not at that point right now. And there have been some beautiful things that have come my way. Some, you know, potential board opportunities in the corporate world, some new nonprofit boards, some other initiatives. Stay tuned. But I'm in a place of receiving rather than retrieving, or I don't know. I tried to make it rhyme, but it didn't work. I'm not chasing anything right now, which is a really beautiful place to be.
What are you most proud of?
The fact that I made it through the delivery. My goodness, I have never been prouder. I was so lucky to have my husband, my mom, and my dad in the room with me when I gave birth to my daughter. Of course, my dad stopped out for the gross part, but just to be able to do that. I mean, human bodies, but particularly female bodies, are insanely impressive. And to be able to give my parents their first grandchild, I mean, that was the coolest thing ever.
Last question. If you can leave our audience with one lasting piece of advice, what would that be?
Be nice to yourself. Everything takes time.
Thank you so much for coming on Redefining Ambition.
Thank you for having me, Jamie. You should be very, very proud of this incredible podcast and how you've built this community of women. And I look forward to hearing the episode.
And I look forward to keeping in touch. Thank you so much.
Hello. We recorded the first part of this episode 9 months ago when you had just become a mother. A really exciting time. In reflecting on this last year, how has motherhood changed or enhanced your thoughts on success, on ambition, and what have you learned about yourself and your outlook on your career ambitions since having a baby?
First of all, thank you so much for having me. You know, the Women's Network is obviously such an incredible resource, and I feel privileged to be able to share what little I know with your community. I think what I've learned is that you have to focus on controlling what you can control and letting go of what you can't. I think that I spent a lot of time before becoming a mother thinking that controlling every single detail would give me a semblance of stability or make me feel successful. And what I've learned is actually focusing and, you know, sort of continuing to spin on that hamster wheel, trying to control things that you can't, waste a lot of time and energy and calories and brain power that you could be using to really up-level and chase things that you know you have control over. So anyway, long story short, when you're responsible for keeping a child alive and, you know, crafting their future, a lot of things feel like small potatoes in the grand scheme of things. And so it's given me a lot of perspective on what is truly critical, what is truly important, and just has made me a much more self-compassionate and accepting human being, which I genuinely think is the key to happiness. You know, treating yourself like you would your best friend,
yeah,
bringing that same compassion to yourself that you would another human being. And like I said, accepting the cards you're dealt rather than fighting against the grain. It's almost like swimming against the tide when you're in the ocean. You keep getting drawn back. What's the point of that?
Right.
So it's been a really enlightening period for me. And I think my definition of success is actually exactly the same. It's just about how I get there. So that's the only thing that's changed is how I get there.
Whereas with ambition, you've had to, I'm sure, prioritize your time in different ways. Do you feel like at this point in your life, your approach or your perception of ambition has evolved or changed? And if so, how? Talking about like flexibility and becoming more ambitious.
I don't know. I think my perspective on ambition is the same in that grit and all that good stuff is still important, right? Mental toughness, resilience. I still use those tools every day. I think it's just about the how. When you're climbing up the hill, when you're getting through these things, when you're teaching yourself to be resilient, when you are, you know, being gritty, what is the self-talk that you're leveraging to get yourself there? I think I was very self-punishing before this, and I've become a little bit more self-soothing. And once you said to yourself in the mirror, girl, what you're going through is extremely tough. I hear you. I see you. That's all you have to say. And then you keep pushing rather than, gosh, you're an idiot, or why can't you do this? That kind of self-chastising narrative doesn't help anyone.
I completely agree. So on the topic of becoming a mother, a lot of people say that once you become a mother, you view the terms empathy and selflessness in slightly or completely different lights. So I'm curious, how has your approach to empathetic and compassionate leadership, which I know you have, evolved or changed? And I want to add a slight note that there are so many people on LinkedIn who have vouched for your leadership, have spoken. I've read those posts about how you lead with kindness and empathy and how they look up to you. And you've been wonderful mentors. So since becoming a mom, has your approach to that empathetic leadership evolved, or do you view leadership in a different light? And if so, how?
Yeah, I'll admit this. I have learned some tough lessons about leadership, even just in the past 2 years. You know, when I joined Ariel Investments, I was tasked with a large scale restructuring of our marketing, communications, public affairs, philanthropy, and government affairs functions. And I centralized them all into one group, right? That required bringing people along and convincing them that my way would be the healthiest for our organization. Some people jumped on board immediately and others found their way out the door through that process. But I think I did reach a point, it was actually right after I'd come back from maternity leave, when someone on my team left, where I said, I need to look inward more and understand what I'm doing wrong here. And I think what I learned was, in the pursuit of excellence, empathy, compassion, et cetera, still have a place. So you can be a perfectionist. That's completely acceptable. But rather than focusing on pushing for excellence yourself, I think you should focus more on enabling excellence through your team. So what are the ways in which you're encouraging that excellence? What are the ways in which you are inspiring that excellence rather than forcing someone to give you what you're expecting from them? Mm. I got some incredible advice actually from my boss, who had heard this advice from someone else, which was, when you're giving, and I must say it dovetails very nicely into my new perspective as a mother. And this advice was, when you're giving someone feedback, imagine that their mother is sitting next to them. Would you speak to them that way if their parent were there?
My gosh, that's such good feedback. Wow.
It gave me the chills when she said it. There were moments, right, where I was delivering feedback or, you know, speaking to my team in a certain way where I don't know that I would be 100% confident and comfortable doing it that way if they're the person who gave life to them were there, the person who views them as their pride and joy, the person who thinks that they are flawless. And so I think bringing that perspective to leadership has really gone a long way. My team's a lot happier, healthier, stronger since I started in, you know, thinking about that. And we're just closer as a team.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you. Okay. Quickly transitioning. I'm curious, what has been the most surprising, thing since becoming a mother that you have learned? And how do you prioritize your time now?
I have learned that women are literally made of magic fairy dust. We can quite literally do anything. I did not know that my body was capable of doing what it's done. I didn't know that my mind was capable of doing what it's done. I thought I was busy before. I thought I was at capacity before. My body and brain just created more capacity, right? More capacity for love, more capacity for time spent, more creativity in how I'm spending that time. I don't know. It's just been a really big shock. I have exceeded my own expectations in every way. And I think the other thing that's been surprising is it's given me a lot more compassion for an understanding of my own mother. And that's been really beautiful just for me to resolve those feelings, right? That any mother-daughter relationship might have, right? Every mother-daughter relationship has its stuff. And I think understanding where she's come from historically and why she is the way she is has just made for a really beautiful evolution of our relationship.
Love that. Okay. Last question. What advice would you tell your younger self about planning out your career? So many people listening to this podcast probably think they either know exactly or have an idea as to how they think they're going to spend the next 3, 5, 10 years. What would you tell your younger self about planning your life and your career in your early 20s?
I would have told myself that I was thinking too small, you know, by having a 5, 10 year plan. When I was in my 20s, I remember telling myself I wanted to be a vice president at a PR agency by the time I was 30. Well, guess what? I was an SVP by 28. You can only limit yourself by being so stringent with these 5-10 year plans. I just focus on investing in the relationships that are important to me, being of service to those who I want to be of service to, and just being known as the best at what I do, working really, really hard. And then from there, things just kind of have come my way, which has been really nice. And I just wish I had told myself it doesn't have to hurt that much, right? You don't need to be so strict with yourself on what needs to happen in what sequence. These things come to you as long as you lay the bricks correctly.
Thank you so much for doing this and all of the sage advice. And I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.